Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Don't you know? Hello, don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia? This is Harvey Wasserman at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We are on for an hour day of Fukushima with two of the world's leading experts, co-authors, with Edwin Lyman of a superb new book called Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. We are coming up on the third, the tragic third anniversary of Fukushima, a week away. March 11th is the actual anniversary. Today is March 4th. Mardi Gras, at least we got something to celebrate. But we're going to talk in great detail for the full hour with David Lockbaum, my old buddy, and Susan Stranahan, both of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We may be joined by Nick Tabbitt at some point. Nick has been coordinating demonstrations around the United States, actually around the world, with presentations to Japanese consulates. I have just actually signed on to present a petition with a good group of people in Los Angeles at the Japanese consulate in Los Angeles on a week from today on March 11th, 3/11/11. I remember, unfortunately, 3 years ago today, working late at night and getting a phone call. I never get a phone call at 2 in the morning, and that's why I work at 2 in the morning and the phone rings. My buddy David in New York State said, "Hey, man, you better go turn on the CNN, and I did, and my life has not been the same since. As people a lot closer, their lives are very, very different than they have been in the past. But let's get right to it, because we've got great guests, great experts with us from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dave Lockbaum and Susan Stranahan. Jump right in, David. I always hesitate to give people credentials, but David, if you will tell us a bit about yourself and then Susan about yourself, please, then we can get to the nitty-gritty here. So Dave Lockbaum, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Harvey. I have a degree in nuclear engineering. I graduated a few weeks after the Three Mile Island accident back in 1979, so I have an alibi for that one. And then worked in the nuclear industry for about 17 years at a number of plants. Most of those that experience was at boiling water reactors like the ones at Fukushima. In fall of 1996, I went to work for the Union of Concerned Scientists, working on their nuclear safety project. I left UCS in 2009 for about a one-year period to work for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as a reactor technology instructor on boiling water reactors, where I taught NRC employees how the thing works, and then returned to UCS in my old job in 2010, where I've been since.
Now, I understand that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, your boss was Monty Burns. Is that correct? Sorry about that. For all you are you Simpson fans, I know, David, you made a reference in a recent article, a superb article you wrote, citing Monty Burns as a possible leader of the nuclear industry. Do you want to explain that reference real quick?
Yeah, Montgomery Burns was the fictional plant manager of the Springfield nuclear plant where Homer Simpson worked, and he all too often that show resembles more of a documentary than a situation comedy. But
well, are they done? I mean, isn't the Simpsons still going? Isn't the Springfield nuke still in operation, or do they have a meltdown and wipe out the whole town there?
I think they applied for and got a 20-year extension, is my understanding.
Right. Well, at least I would have to say that the Simpsons ratings are better than the nuclear power industry's ratings at this point in time. They sure get the job done a lot better. I am a big Simpsons fan, and I love Monty Burns. I think you understated Monty Burns' position, though. Isn't he the owner of the Springfield nuke, or is he just the plant manager?
That's correct. He is actually the owner.
So there you go. GE brings good things to life. Susan Stranahan, tell us who you are, please.
Thank you for inviting Dave and me to join you, Harvey. I am a journalist who worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer during the Three Mile Island accident and the coverage that the Inquirer did about that accident won the Pulitzer Prize. I left the Inquirer in 2000 but continued my interest in writing about nuclear safety issues, and of course my path crossed with Dave routinely because he was such a good source for those of us in the news media. After Fukushima, I was delighted when the Union of Concerned Scientists came to me and asked me to team up with Dave and Ed Lyman to do a book on the accident. It was an opportunity that doesn't come along very often. I guess you need a nuclear accident to get something as interesting as that as a project to work on. But we spent a good deal of time going over the accident. I, as a journalist, was very interested in the human drama. This was a technological accident, but it was just chock full of incredible drama. And a number of the reviews for our book, which is Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Accident, have described it as thriller-like. And I think that's good because I'm hoping that by appealing to a broad audience that Dave and Ed and I can get out the message that we hope to convey in the book.
So what is the message you hope to convey in the book?
I'll let Dave take care of that one.
Well, I think that what I'd hope people come away from the book would be that it can happen here. We say in the book that it wasn't a Japanese accident. It was a nuclear accident that happened in Japan. Any of our reactors faced with that kind of challenge of an extended power outage would have ended up in the same place in meltdown. It might have taken a little bit longer, might have taken a slightly different path, but the destination would have been the same. So given the magnitude of that disaster, it'd be foolish for us not to learn as much as we can from it and reduce the chances that one of our reactors becomes the next Fukushima.
Well, God forbid. Let's jump back. Well, okay, so let's get right down to it. Susan, I presume you're the primary writer of this book. Being a journalist myself, it's very well written. Beautifully
done. Thank you
very
much. Yeah, I contributed a fair portion of it. Dave and Ed obviously brought their technical expertise and their deep background in this subject, so it was a combination of three people joining together to do it. But yeah, the narrative was an easy one for us to assemble because what we were really watching was a what they call in the newspaper business a TikTok. It was a moment by moment by moment cascading series of failures, and these heroic workers in Japan just nothing seemed to go right, and so we were able to tell it that way. And then we also told it through the lens of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, 7,000 miles away, watching this accident unfold and really being as confused as the poor folks at Fukushima Daiichi on so many levels. Yet, as Dave said, this very easily could have been an accident in the United States. So it really, I think the point that we're trying to make in the book is that no one in Japan or the United States or any place else for that matter was prepared for the events that began on March the 11th in 2011.
Okay, so I got to tell you, I was in Japan in the mid-1970s and participated in marches and meetings to the extent that I could understand what was going on about Fukushima. In fact, I wrote an article in 1970 that was published in the Progressive in 1977 talking about the opposition to Fukushima. And you say that people weren't prepared, but I certainly remember people in Japan saying, hey, don't build a nuclear power plant in an earthquake tsunami zone. We do have two reactors in the United States that are technically in an earthquake tsunami zone, and that would be the two at Diablo Canyon, California. Do you think there's a comparable threat at Diablo Canyon that was experienced at Fukushima?
I think so. We issued a report last fall called Seismic Shift, where we pointed out that two earthquake faults that were identified since that plant was under construction placed the plant at a greater earthquake threat than it's protected against. So in other words, Diablo Canyon is protected against an earthquake unless an earthquake happens. And that's really not the way it's supposed to be.
Will you say that again, please? You said it so quietly, a matter of factly. Can you say that again?
Diablo Canyon is protected against an earthquake unless an earthquake occurs. It's
okay,
like,
so that's very reassuring. I sleep a lot better to hearing that. What do you mean exactly by that statement?
Well, it's designed for an earthquake that produces ground motion of 0.4 Gs. But the earthquake faults that have been found near the plant have been shown to or estimated to cause ground motions of 0.75 Gs or greater, more than double what it's protected against, which means that it most likely won't survive that earthquake. So the only way it's safe is if the earthquake doesn't occur, and that's kind of like Fukushima. Fukushima had a seawall that was great unless a tsunami arrived.
Yeah, right. Now, am I wrong? There's so much to ask you, I got to sort it all out, but I want to check this one fact really quickly. I have read, and I've actually seen pictures, that indicate that there was a natural seawall at Fukushima, and that TEPCO and the builders of Fukushima took it down because they did not want to spend the money to be pumping the water up from the ocean. Is that correct?
That is correct. If you look at a picture of the site, units 1, 2, 3, and 4, the ones that blew up and had problems, are closer to the sea level because they took away the cliff that was there so they could build them closer to the sea for two reasons. One, that most of the equipment arrived at the plant by barge, and they would have had to lug it uphill to where the plant was being built, so they lowered the mountain rather than do that. And then as long as the plant operated, they would have had to pump water uphill, so they were able to get by with smaller pumps that cost less by removing the mountain. Units and 5 and 6 next door are still on the cliff because they decided not to excavate the cliff and just buy bigger pumps. And they came through okay.
All right, so let's put this in perspective. What you're saying is that and allow me, please correct me if I misparaphrase you, that the owners of of Fukushima, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, when they were building the plant, despite the fact that people were out in the streets demanding they not build it there and warning against what would happen or could happen if there was an earthquake and tsunami, despite all this, been told that the cliff was 85 feet high. And that they had the option of building the nuclear plant on top of the cliff, and instead they removed the cliff and the mountain and the seawall, however you want to call it, put the reactors essentially at sea level or slightly above, and stuck the backup generators in the basement, stuck the fuel pools 100 feet in the air, and proceeded to build these reactors to save the money for moving the equipment up from the barges and pumping the water up from the ocean. Is that correct?
That's pretty much correct, yeah. And the money they saved, it won't even pay for the damages that it's caused. It wasn't like they put it in escrow to be paid back later.
I think one of the other interesting bits of geology is that the plant apparently is built atop an underground river or a former river, and so there's a huge amount of groundwater flow coming from behind the plant, the mountains behind the plant, running underneath the plant, and that, of course, has just compounded the problems that they're having with water issues now.
God, Well, okay, we're talking with David Lochbaum and Susan Stranahan from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Their new book is Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. That is just shocking information. Now, the reality is that they continue to say, the owners of these reactors, that they couldn't have foreseen what happened. But, tell us this then, Dave and Susan. If they had built these reactors on top of the original cliff that was there, what would have happened in this earthquake / tsunami?
Well, I'll take a stab at that, and Susan can supplement it. The earthquake took away the normal supply of power, the transmission power grid. The earthquake downed some of the power poles and transmission lines. So the plant would have been left without its normal supply of power. The backup to that were the emergency diesel generators. Each of the six reactors at Fukushima had two emergency diesel generators. Those likely would not have been flooded by the tsunami waters as happened in real life had they been up on the cliff. But the emergency diesel generators, just like your car engine, needs a cooling system. Otherwise, the emergency diesel generators overheat and fail. The tsunami, even with the plant up on a cliff, would likely have taken out the pumps that send cooling water through the emergency diesel generators. So the emergency diesel generators likely would have failed due to overheating instead of being flooded. That would have left the plant with batteries, which they had. The plant only had 8 hours worth of batteries. The power outage lasted 9 days. But the batteries would have given workers perhaps some time to get some Rube Goldberg or ad hoc repairs going. The tsunami caused so much damage to the infrastructure, it made it hard for workers to go through darkened buildings in water that was 18 inches deep to make some of these manual actions in time. With the plant up on the cliff, they might have had a better chance of success.
Well, also, as I have read, I think in your book and elsewhere, that they did go out to the parking lot and take batteries out of the various cars. And, of course, the cars would have survived the tsunami a lot better, 85 feet in the air, than they did. So maybe they would have had more car batteries. Of course, also, power trucks were sent towards Fukushima, which didn't make it because of the traffic, as I understand. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's also a story that the U.S. military airlifted a fire truck into a naval base north of the plant, but the Japanese didn't allow it to leave the base because it wasn't licensed to travel on Japanese roads.
Well, we like, at least they followed the rules. But how much damage at Fukushima was done by the earthquake as opposed to the tidal wave? And would we have had meltdowns at Fukushima even if the tidal wave had not happened? Either one of you is welcome to answer any of these questions, please.
It's kind of difficult to answer that because the blackout, the power outage, took away the computers that track data. But from everything I've looked at, had it just been the earthquake, you and I wouldn't be talking about Fukushima today. The backup power supplies would have saved the day and not caused the three meltdowns. It was the flooding of the backup power supplies and the batteries that caused the problems.
One of the things that we talk about in the book, and I came at this as someone who was eager to learn. I've written about nuclear issues for a long time, but really had so much to learn. But the thing that struck me was that, first of all, the assumption was that if there was an accident at a reactor, the other reactors somehow magically would have been spared, and therefore they would have been able to provide backup power. They would have been able to provide emergency manpower to go in and help the affected reactor. And so suddenly you had an accident that was occurring simultaneously or nearly simultaneously at multiple reactors. And the planning just hadn't been thought through that could happen. And so here you have this sequence of events of multiple reactors at a plant that has just been subjected to a horrific natural disaster. And it's, as David said, these poor workers are in the dark. They're aftershocks. They're worried there's going to be another tsunami that's going to sweep them away. They're trying to manage to get even around the grounds where there's live wire down and water everywhere and open manhole covers. And the irony is that, yes, they have to go up into the parking lot and steal batteries out of cars and bring them down and try and buy time. And in the end, the time ran out.
Well, what would happen in a similar situation at Diablo Canyon? Now, I don't think they took down the cliff. The cliffs at the Diablo Canyon. Let's set the stage here. These two reactors in Central California on the coast, 8 or 9 miles, due west of San Luis Obispo, they are on the coast. They're surrounded by earthquake faults, but they are pretty high in the air. What do you think would happen if a similar situation hit the Diablo Canyon?
Well, what doomed Fukushima was the 1-2 punch of the earthquake followed by the tsunami. The 1-2 punch at Diablo Canyon would likely be the earthquake, which triggered a fire, and Diablo Canyon has never met the NRC's fire protection regulations for even a single minute. Fire, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, represents half the risk of core damage at the nuclear power plants, which means it equals all other hazards combined. The reason is for the same as the water at Fukushima. Fire can take out safety systems and their backups, so it can take all of the safety systems off the table, as it did at Browns Ferry many years ago. So the 1-2 punch at Diablo Canyon would be the earthquake that breaks some lubricating oil lines or hydrogen gas lines that starts a fire. The fire protection system's not guaranteed. You know, again, Diablo Canyon is protected against a fire unless it has a fire. So you'd have the 1-2 punch being earthquake fire, the outcome being the same, meltdown.
All right, we're talking with Dave Lockbaum and Susan Stranahan here about the Fukushima disaster, the nuclear power plant, and the plants. Of course, we never talked in any of these times about multiple explosions. I started with nuclear power before both of you were born in 1973, and in all the years that that we discussed this issue, no one ever talked about multiple explosions. In fact, no one talked about explosions at all. The nuclear power industry was very adamant about denying that an atomic reactor could ever explode. And I want to get to this, Susan, especially with your detailed experience, real-time experience at Three Mile Island. There was the explosions, as I understand them, and correct me if I'm wrong, at Fukushima, the actual explosions, as opposed to the meltdowns, were caused by hydrogen gas in units 1, 2, and 3, and in unit 4, which did not have a meltdown that we know of, because spent fuel was allegedly in a fuel pool 100 feet in the air, although we need to talk about that. But nonetheless, there was a hydrogen bubble at Three Mile Island. And there were people who were afraid it would explode and take the whole reactor down with it. Can you talk to us about what almost happened at Three Mile Island?
I can talk something about that, and Dave will have to weigh in a little bit on more of the technical things. But there was over the weekend of the Three Mile Island accident a growing fear about this hydrogen bubble. And that had developed in the reactor, and the fear that yes, it would explode and possibly release massive amounts of radiation across central Pennsylvania, and that just panicked people. Governor Thornburgh, Pennsylvania Governor Thornburgh, recommended that pregnant women and children leave, and that schools close, and that was all it took. I think something like 150,000 people evacuated.
Right.
And
although he did it 2 days into the accident.
Pardon?
He did it 2 days into the accident. He waited 2 days.
Right.
There was a lot of yelling about that on both sides. There are still people in the nuclear industry who are angry that he actually asked people to leave. And then,
well,
of course,
was,
the anti-nuclear
you know,
people say
that. He was in
a
bind, Harvey, because he was not getting good information. And I think that's an extraordinarily common thread with Fukushima. There just was a failure to communicate, and people in Pennsylvania were desperate to find somebody they could trust, just like the people at Fukushima were, I think. And so Governor Thornburgh, who's not a nuclear expert, he was a federal prosecutor, but he decided enough is enough and issued this recommendation. And I think the sense in Pennsylvania was one of finally somebody is speaking the truth here, and it may be more than maybe this is overreaction, but at least somebody's reacting. And I think that it turned out that the hydrogen issue was not a critical issue, but boy, the people of Pennsylvania didn't know that, and took off. And so I think that the lesson that we got from Three Mile Island was that, first of all, that where do you get your reliable information, and second of all, do the experts really know what's going on? And I'm not sure that was the case either at Three Mile Island or at Fukushima.
Well, Dave, from a technical point of view, David Lockbaum, what was the possibility that there could have been a hydrogen explosion? Was there a danger of a hydrogen explosion at Three Mile Island?
Yes, the hydrogen was produced at Three Mile Island, as it was at Fukushima, by a chemical reaction. As the fuel overheated and melted down, it reacted with the water to split the water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen molecules. And also, there was a reaction with the metal itself that produced a large amount of hydrogen. About 10 hours into the Three Mile Island accident, there was a detonation of hydrogen within its containment that caused the pressure inside containment to spike by almost a factor of 10, go up 10 times as much. The containment didn't fail like it did at Fukushima, but there was a hydrogen ignition that caused some concern. At Fukushima, the hydrogen that was produced by the same mechanism, the meltdown of the fuel produced hydrogen, got outside the containment building into the building that surrounds the thick, 5-foot-thick concrete walls, and it detonated in those buildings, almost like nuclear dominoes, one reactor after another, as the hydrogen blew up in buildings that wasn't designed to handle that kind of pressure.
Now, you know, there is a story that the nuclear opponents of Three Mile Island Unit 2, which opened in only 3 months before the accident in 1978. It opened December 28th, 1978, and it blew on this March 28th, 1979. So I think it was exactly 3 months.
And I think it was actually, I think, Harvey, it had been operating 1 day short of a year.
Okay. Really? So it opened March 27th, 1978, and then it blew on... Oh, no. It would have opened March 29th, 1978, and it blew on March 28th, 79. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's right.
Okay. So, but there was a fight over the containment, the strength of the containment dome at Three Mile Island. And there was a woman whose name I cannot remember, and I should because she should be honored, who just really was relentless in demanding a stronger containment dome at Three Mile Island, because if you've ever flown into Harrisburg, the TMI is right in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport. And, the nuclear legend or the urban legend, whatever you want to say, is that because the containment dome was strengthened by this public demand, that may be one of the reasons why it held. Is there any credibility to that assertion?
Well, there's definitely credibility to the fact that the containment was strengthened because of the proximity to the airport. Three Mile Island and Seabrook are the only two plants in the United States that were designed with accidental aircraft impacts in mind, and both of them had their containment strengthened as a result. Whether the containment would have endured in its original configuration? I've never looked at.
Well, it's an interesting question, and certainly one to think about when you think about activism among the people who question nuclear power and who really fight these things. But I remember the question, you know, I remember Walter Cronkite on TV talking about the possibility of a hydrogen explosion. What would have happened at Three Mile Island, and what would have been the implications at Three Mile Island if we'd have had an explosion there like the ones at Fukushima 1, 2, 3?
Well, I've looked at the NRC documents. They were concerned about the hydrogen, and they had plans for a bunker so that people could stay and deal with Three Mile Island after, if the containment failed due to a hydrogen explosion. Fortunately, they never had to go past the drawing board with those kind of contingencies, but as bad as Three Mile Island was, things would have been much, much worse. It's hard to speculate. I have more of a bowling ball than a crystal ball when trying to speculate what that might have done, but it wouldn't have been good, that's for sure.
Right. And well, one thing about Three Mile Island, different from Fukushima, is that TMI was new, only the unit 2, and so the radioactive burden inside the reactor was nothing approaching Fukushima 1, 2, 3. Unit 1 opened in 1970 or 71, so there must have been a tremendous burden of radioactive materials inside Unit 1 that wasn't present at TMI Unit 2. Is that correct? Would that be a proper characterization?
Well, after a plant runs for about 3-4 months, it's pretty much got to load it up, all the cylinder or the revolver or whatever it is. Because, you know, again, they generally refuel every year. Nowadays, they refuel every 18 months to 2 years. So once a core is operated, even a new core is operated for about 3-4 months, it's got a fairly large inventory of nasty stuff.
Right. Very, very nasty. The book is Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Two of the three authors are with us, Susan Q. Stranahan and David Lockbaum. Have we actually learned anything from Fukushima? Is there anything that's been changed in the 3 years since Fukushima to make our reactors safer in the United States?
The NRC, in a year after the accident, ordered owners to take steps to better protect or reduce their vulnerabilities from the Fukushima hazards. To date, a grand total of none of the reactors have completed those steps.
All right, wait. That's not nine. That's none. Is that correct?
None. That is
correct.
Like the
women who are, you know, in monasteries. None.
Yeah.
Okay.
Between slim and none, those that have fixed it. Yeah. The part of that was to do some walkdowns to look at your plant's protection against flooding and earthquakes. And rather than have them all do it at the same time and inundate the NRC with a bunch of these hazard analyses, it was broken up into one-third of the plants the first year, one-third of the plants the second year, and the remainder of the third year. The plants in that first year, 20% of them didn't get done in time, and they asked the NRC for more time, and it was granted. So I don't think these plants are licensed long enough to complete all the steps they need to protect.
Well, one of the points that we make in the book, Harvey, is that so much of nuclear regulation is what we call fighting the last war, and that the NRC takes a look at Fukushima, and it says, all right, what do we need to do at U.S. reactors to prevent an accident like Fukushima? And what we argue in the book is that that's just the opposite of what they should do. They should be saying, all right, there was an accident at Fukushima. This happened. But what else might happen? What other possibilities are there? The line we use in the book is that the safety bar is set at X. Nobody asks, what if X plus 1 happens? So if the NRC takes a look at Fukushima and says, oh boy, we need to do X, Y, and Z, and as Dave said, they're not in any real rush. What would make much more sense is to just set aside preconceived ideas and say, let's consider all possibilities, not just what happened at Fukushima, but any other, you know, any other realistic problem, and assess it as it poses a threat, rather than looking, they should be looking forward rather than backward at the last accident.
The other thing that makes that worse is that the federal government actually discourages safety improvements.
Oh, my God. Tell us about that.
Because the catastrophic consequences of an accident was so large, power plant owners couldn't go down to State Farm or Prudential and get liability insurance. So in 1957, the government passed the Price-Anderson Act, which provides federal liability insurance in case of a nuclear accident. The problem with that is that if you had private liability insurance, if you came up with a safer containment or safer cooling system or power system, that would reduce your liability insurance premium every year because you're operating a safer plant. But with Price-Anderson, if you spend $5 or $1,000, whatever, for a better, safer plant, your insurance premium stays the same. So there's no financial benefits, incentives, for designing and building and operating safer plants.
Right, and since the owners of these reactors are not liable for any damage they do to the general public, and was anybody prosecuted at Three Mile Island for negligence or anything like that? There's a stunned silence. No. Has anybody going to be prosecuted at Fukushima? I don't think so, right? I mean, these guys have already been exonerated from all. Not only that, correct me if I'm wrong, David and Susan, but I understand that TEPCO made over $8 billion last year. Is that possible?
I don't know how much they made. Getting back to an earlier question, the NRC did fine Metropolitan Edison $155,000 for melting down Three Mile Island. So that was a message to everybody else not to do that.
Yeah, that was a pretty.
That said, I'm shaking in their boots.
I mean, I know they probably had to shut down their Coke machine. It's really an astonishing situation here. Now there's two reactors being built in Georgia and two in South Carolina. How well insulated are we from similar disasters at those two reactors now under construction? We know, of course, that the two reactors in Georgia just got $8.5 billion from, I guess, $6.5 and more to come, something like that. Are these reactors, which are a different design from the ones of Fukushima, are they going to be safer than Fukushima? Let's put it that way.
Those four reactors are what are called AP1000s. They're Westinghouse reactors. The next evolution, every step to the Westinghouse reactors that are operating today, they do incorporate some features to make them safer than existing reactors. They use a lot more what are called passive safety systems, like water tanks located up above the reactor, so that in the event of an accident, you can use gravity rather than electric power-driven pumps to get water into the reactor core for cooling. But they also, those safety systems only give you so much time. The water tanks are only sized to last for like 48 hours. Then you have to pump more water up to the tank so gravity can do its thing again. So it buys you some time, but it doesn't guarantee you safety. We testified about a decade ago before Congress about these loan guarantees and other subsidies, saying that Price-Anderson should be appealed and let companies go out and get their own liability. You know, if these new reactors truly are safer, then you don't need federal liability insurance anymore. None of the vendors decided to take us up on that.
I've been doing this for 40 years, and I'm still left speechless sometimes by the nuclear industry. It's truly astounding. Are there any actual prototypes of the AP1000s that are being built in the Southeast now that we can point to for experience?
Only on computer models, and I don't think there's been a meltdown yet in cyberspace.
Well, the Chinese are building some of these, right?
The Chinese are, but they're not in operation yet, so nobody's seen one actually split an atom yet.
So they're all perfectly safe at this point in time. The book is Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, with Dave Lockbaum and Susan Stranahan. My understanding is Fukushima 1, well, actually all the reactors of Fukushima, but the Mark 1 reactor, Fukushima 1, we have 23 virtually identical in the U.S., is that correct?
That's right.
And are any of them threatened? Now, we have an interesting allegory here, I guess you'd call it, or analogy. A number of these all the reactors are either on lakes, rivers, or the ocean. A number of the reactors in the United States are downriver from large dams. Could a dam break actually simulate a tsunami at some of these reactors?
In June of 2010, 9 months before the Fukushima accident, the NRC issued an order requiring the Duke Energy Company to better protect the three reactors at the Oconee nuclear plant in South Carolina, because the Jocassee Dam, which is 22 miles upriver of that site, if it were to fail, would flood the site to 14 feet, almost the same depth that the tsunami flooded Fukushima. And the NRC calculated there would be a 100% chance that all three reactors would melt down. And the NRC seldom underestimates risk. So that's why they ordered that company to fix those. Today, those fixes have not yet been finished.
Are they even designed? I mean, have they even talked about what they do if they fix them?
Yeah, they have some of the measures included putting in some dikes and levees that would direct the floodwaters around the plant to lessen how much arrived at the site and provide better protection of the systems that need it to survive to protect the core. Those, you know, safety IOUs protect nobody. You have to have those lessons in the rearview mirror if they're going to provide any protection.
So they've done nothing, basically.
It's worth noting, Harvey, that more than 1.4 million people live within 50 miles of Oconee.
Well, let's talk about Indian Point, which is, 25, 35 miles north of Manhattan. My understanding is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has ranked Indian Point at the top of the scale of dangerous reactors in terms of earthquake damage. And my understanding is that there, how many, 50 million people within a 50-mile radius, something like that, at Indian Point?
Well, actually, that wasn't the NRC that ranked them high. It was Bill Deadman, and Susan has an interesting anecdote about how Bill Deadman was treated.
All right, let's hear it.
Yeah, it was Deadman had been digging through the NRC archives looking for a Fukushima story and came across the study that the NRC had done but had not really publicized, and that was reassessing earthquake damage for U.S. reactors. And it had been given a generic name and really had been largely hidden by the virtue of the fact it wasn't easily identifiable. So Bill goes through and analyzes the data himself, and he gets some help from a math professor, and they look at the numbers. And so the next day he comes out with a story that that says that of all the U.S. reactors, Indian Point is the one at greatest vulnerability to earthquakes. And in the peak of this accident, the NRC public affairs folks spent hours trying to discredit Deadman for reporting on this story. In essence, he'd used the NRC's own data for his story, and but the NRC spent hours using its seismic experts, who theoretically should have been looking at stuff going on in Japan, to try and discredit Deadman's piece. And in the end, the experts said that they could find nothing wrong with it, and Deadman was vindicated in his reporting. But there was great unhappiness in the public affairs office at the NRC.
Well, take us through. We want to jazz up the crew here in New York that's engineering this show. So take us through what would happen if the Ramapo Fault, which is runs underneath Indian Point or near it, went off, and we had meltdowns at Indian Point. Tell us what would happen exactly.
Well, the earthquake would either directly cause some of the safety systems to fail, or would, as I mentioned earlier, cause a fire that would have the same effect. Within minutes, 30 minutes to hours afterwards, depending on how quickly the systems were lost, the reactor cores would overheat and lots of hydrogen and radioactivity would be released. If the containment was intact and not damaged by the earthquake, which is a pretty good chance, then the only way for that radiation to get out is if the cooling systems for the containment failed, the pressure inside the containment would go up and it would start pushing hydrogen out through cracks in the walls, around where places where pipes penetrate through the walls and aren't fully sealed. So the radioactivity would get out, and depending on the weather conditions, which way the wind was blowing, would either pose a risk to New York City or elsewhere. It, again, wouldn't be a good day.
Well, what would happen to cause an explosion that would do to the containments what was done at Fukushima?
Well, interesting enough, Indian Point, after the Three Mile Island accident, installed hydrogen recombiners inside containment that were to deal with the hydrogen threat by recombining the loose hydrogen molecules with oxygen molecules to make water rather than have this hydrogen gas float around. One of the units, and I can't remember if it was Unit 2 or Unit 3, subsequently disabled that system.
Why? Why did they do that?
It was too expensive to maintain. And
oh,
they convinced the NRC that it could never happen again, so they were able. In my state here in Tennessee, the Watts Bar plant, which is a Westinghouse plant like Indian Point, took out its hydrogen recombiners but left them in the emergency procedures. So in case of an accident, the operators were told to go turn on the hydrogen recombiners. Which, if I was an operator, I'd say, well, since they're not here, I'm going to get in my car and try to go find out where they went.
That has to be repeated. You're telling me that after Three Mile Island, in one of the two operating reactors at Indian Point, which is just north of New York City, I've been by it many times on the train, if the Ramapo Fault went off and caused a major disaster at Indian Point and the fuel started to melt and the hydrogen was created, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, understanding the extreme danger that could come with a hydrogen explosion, installed a recombining unit that would remove much of the danger, of course not all, but much of the danger of a hydrogen explosion. And this was set to work, except that the owners of Indian Point argued that it was using too much electricity, I guess, or whatever, and successfully persuaded the Nuclear Commission, Regulatory Commission, to allow them to remove the hydrogen container, recombiners, which they had installed in the wake of Three Mile Island. Is that what you're telling me?
That's basically it, yeah.
So, so what drugs do these guys take?
Have about 30 years.
What's that?
Nuclear accidents only have a shelf life of about 25 years, and then you don't have to do anything to protect against them anymore.
So you didn't answer my question. What drug are these guys on?
One of the interesting things, Harvey, is that you'll recall that that during the Fukushima accident, the NRC issued a 50-mile evacuation zone warning for Americans that were in Japan. And it turned out that was very, very prudent because the wind currents were carrying a very large radiation plume northwest of the plant that went out about 35, 40 miles. So the 50-mile zone was a good one for the Americans. Yet, after the accident, the NRC has remained adamant that a 10-mile evacuation zone is adequate in the United States, despite the clear evidence in Fukushima Daiichi that the wind doesn't just stop blowing it when it hits the 10-mile mark. And so the NRC's point is that if need be, if the evacuation zone had to be broaden beyond the 10 miles, there'd be plenty of time to get people out and get them moving safely out of harm's way. And if you look at a plant like Indian Point, for example, or Limerick, which is close to Philadelphia, and others that are close to large urban areas, I can't conceive of how you would move that many people safely. Even a 50-mile zone seems a real stretch of an imagination. But the NRC has not decided that perhaps the 10-mile zone wouldn't be adequate in the case of a spear accident.
Also, to add to that, Susan mentioned earlier the X+1 scenario. That also applies to that 50-mile evacuation recommendation in Japan. It was asked, as that was being discussed, somebody asked, well, what about further out? And the NRC staff answered that our computer models only evaluate out to 50 miles.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good to hear. We're glad about that. I do want to mention, I do have a piece that's being posted today at truthdig.com, a website based in California, about the USS Ronald Reagan. Now, the Reagan, which is our own, very own lucky dragon, and we just had, or unlucky dragon, we just had the 60th anniversary of the lucky dragon, which was, shall we say, saturated with radiation on March 1st, 1954. The USS Ronald Reagan, by an account which I just saw in an interview with one of the crew members, was within a mile of Fukushima. Now, there's some argument about how close the Reagan really was, but this crew member who was on deck says that she saw the reactor, and they were a mile away on March 12th, 2011. And that they experienced a warm cloud. It was in the 20s in the snowstorm when they were there. They were there to do humanitarian work. And that this warm cloud with a metallic taste came over the boat. And very soon thereafter, they moved the boat 100 miles away. And we have since come across, FOIA request, dialogue among the American officials saying that even 100 miles away, the background radiation was 30 times normal. So as it turns out, and you can comment on this, it appears that except for the plant workers at Fukushima, the 5,500 people on the Ronald Reagan may have gotten the highest dose of radiation from Fukushima of anybody.
It's possible. There's also some Japanese civilians that live northwest of the plant that were in the direction of the wind path,
yeah,
and weren't evacuated in a timely manner. So those individuals are also at harm. What disturbs me about the Reagan story is that sailors who enter the reactor compartments of the Reagan must wear radiation film badges to monitor how much radioactivity they pick up, if any, because there's a potential they could be exposed to radiation in those areas. But sailors on the deck, air crew, and so on, aren't issued radiation badges. So basically the burden's left up to them to prove, first, that they were exposed to radiation, and second, that any injuries or harm that they had was due to that exposure. They should have been equipped with radiation detectors. If you're entering an area next to a nuclear power plant that's having a meltdown, radiation badges would probably be a good idea.
Well, of course, the contention, and there has been a class action suit filed. The contention is that the Navy actually didn't know that Fukushima was blowing up, and I would say that's probably credible, at least for the first day. I mean, the Prime Minister of Japan didn't know up for a while, so why would they tell the Navy? And then, of course, as soon as they found out, the Navy did hightail it out of there, but they had radiation readings 100 miles away. As I said, they were 30 times background. My piece is at truthdig.com, and your book, Susan Stranahan and David Lockbaum with Ed Lyman, is Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. We're down to our last 4 minutes. Tell us really quickly websites and other places people can go to see about this book.
There is a website, Harvey, called FukushimaStory.com, and that has some information on the book, and it has a lot of background information. And of course, the Union of Concerned scientist website, which is UCSUSA.org, has reams and reams of material about nuclear power safety and other nuclear issues.
Well, the UCS has been with us a long time. I actually met both Henry Kendall and Daniel Ford. It's kind of like meeting Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby. But nonetheless, David, really quickly, a lot of controversy about the spent fuel in Unit 4's pool. What do we know about that real quick and the rods that are still up there?
Well, initially it was thought that the reason the Unit 4 reactor building blew up was because the spent fuel in the pool had overheated, melted down, and produced the hydrogen. It's now pretty clear that hydrogen came through a line that connected Unit 4 with Unit 3, so it was hydrogen from Unit 3's core meltdown that got into Unit 4 and exploded. Last November, TEPCO began unloading the irradiated fuel from the spent fuel pool on Unit 4 into casks. They did that after shoring up the fuel pool because the earthquake and the explosion and the tons of water being dropped from above weakened the structure. So first they restored some of the integrity of the buildings. Now they're unloading the pool, which is the right step that needs to be done.
Do we know how it's going? Is there any information?
The first transfers went pretty well. First they unloaded new fuel.
Right.
They also first lifted off the reactor vessel head and the drywall head just to show that heavy weights could be moved without making things worse. The initial irradiated fuel transfers went according to plan. There were no surprises in those steps. The lesson learned here though, was that Fukushima had over 400 fuel assemblies in dry storage at the time of the earthquake and tsunami that came through unscathed.
Okay.
It was the fuel in the pools and the fuel in the reactors that caused problems. In this country, we need to accelerate the transfer of irradiated fuel out of the pools into dry casks and learn the one positive thing that came out of the Fukushima disaster.
All right. Aside from the fact that the windmill offshore from Fukushima was unscathed also and is operating perfectly well, this has been a fascinating hour. I have to have you back. There's still way more to discuss. Fukushima, the story of a nuclear disaster. We've talked with Dave Lockbaum and Susan Stranahan. Thank you so much for a really informative hour. My new piece is at truthdig.com on the USS Ronald Reagan. Horrifying tragedy that's ongoing. Dave and Susan, I want to thank you and Ed Lyman for your superb work on this. You've been a source of very important information, and if you can, we will be back with you. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, another hour of scintillating, uplifting conversation about the nuclear disaster all over the world. Solar energy does work, folks, and that windmill of Fukushima is spinning away and generating electricity. We'll be back next week on the anniversary of the Fukushima disaster to have more about atomic energy and the survival of our planet. Until then, we will see you in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a soul?
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know?